Hello and welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, a Cinemlinx podcast where we discuss the latest books and novels with the people who wrote them. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you have maybe found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. If you like that music, you've got great taste. That's Sam Witwer and the Crash Tones. If you want to hear more of the Crash Tones, you can download their latest album, Revenge of the Crash Tones, on iTunes or visit samwitwer.com. Today in the show, we've got one of the great authors working today, Ms. Elia Dawn Johnson, author of many great books and short stories, but for the purposes of today's show, we're going to talk about the newly released Trouble with the Saints. Full disclosure, this is my favorite book so far this year, and I couldn't wait to talk to Elia not only about her inspiration behind this incredible story, but her unique process as well. The themes in Trouble with the Saints are very much still relevant today, and I asked her, as an American who's been living in Mexico for the past 6 years, about many of the parallels she sees in America today and her story of Black people making their way in the 1940s United States. This is a spoiler discussion, so please, if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled, better stop listening now, but definitely double back after you've read the book. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Great one today. I'm very excited about this. This is one of these books that's been buzzy, I guess. Is that a good word? It's been buzzy lately. And this is an author who's sort of was off the grid for a little bit, maybe even literally. We'll talk about that. But she's back with a brand new novel. It's called Trouble the Saints. It's been out for a week or two now. We'll let her sort of talk about what it's about.
Sorry about that. She just barks at anybody who comes up the street.
I have two upstairs, and I'm waiting for them to bark as well, so it's fine. Anyways, with me today, and her dog is, what's your dog's name?
It's Kisantong.
Kisantong. What kind of dog is Kisantong?
She's some kind of houndish mutt.
Yeah. We'll talk about that, because did you pick her up where you live now, or did you bring her with you?
Yeah, no, we she's new. We just got her, really.
Oh, exciting. Yeah. Anyways, with me today is Elia Dawn Johnson. Hi, Elia. Elia, I'm sorry. Like papaya, right.
Like papaya.
Yes. How are you?
I'm good. Lovely morning.
Good. That's nice. Let's talk about the dog. You just got a new dog.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that... like as of, I guess now officially a month, I moved from Mexico City to my partner's hometown, which is in extremely rural Mexico.
Okay.
And it's been a totally huge change. I'm very exciting, you know, all sorts of new things, because I'm very much a city girl. So this is all different and new. We visited his parents one day, and his mother just had two puppies running around, and we were like, what? Why? What? And she said, do you want one? And my partner said, sure. And we just carried her back here. So I don't know exactly how this happened, but I have a dog. So
what's the dog population like where you are? Is there a lot of them running around? Is there a good program set up to make sure they find homes, or?
No, it's really interesting, honestly. Their dogs just run around. I mean, quite literally. There's just a lot of, and I thought, you know, it was because there were a lot of street dogs, but actually there aren't really street dogs. It's that a lot of people tend to have a lot of dogs, but the dogs just kind of like leave the house and might go away for a day or two and they come back. They're all very savvy. So, you know, some people have dogs that are more like what we think of as like pet dogs, but most of the time it's like that. And so I don't know. And the other thing is that people let their chickens run around all the time too. And they train the dogs not to eat the chickens. Like they both just coexist.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
I travel to Honduras every spring just to get away. I'm in Canada. I'm in Toronto. And just to get away from the Canadian winters. And it's amazing because I'm a huge, I'm a dog person, and they're everywhere down there. And to your point, every one of them, they're like, oh, that's so-and-so's dog. That's so-and-so's dog. But they're just... Right? They're all out running around in packs doing their thing. And it's great. As a dog lover, it's great. But at first, it's shocking, right? Because you're like, who are these stray dogs? They're like, no, they all have owners. Like, all right, cool.
Yeah, no, it's really, really different. It was definitely a moment of culture shock for me to kind of navigate that. I mean, and some of them kind of like my partner's grandfather died, and his dog kind of just stayed in his grandfather's house. Just kind of like walks around and like visits all the various family members, and they'll like throw him some tortillas, but he's sort of kind of not exactly ownerless, you know, but they all still think of him as the grandfather's dog.
Interesting. So if you haven't picked up on it yet, she now lives in, you live in Mexico now. And it's been 6 years, right?
It's been 6 years, yeah.
And you were in Washington, D.C. before? Was that your last U.S. place before you moved down there?
No, I grew up in D.C. Okay. And I moved to New York, like, when I was 18.
Okay,
so
okay.
Then I lived there till 2000, yeah, until I left for Mexico, so until 2014. It was right. New Year's Day, 2014.
No, really? Wow. Yeah. Talk about, starting a new year off. What an adventure. also sort of significant in your life that year was, that was previous to Trouble the Saints. That was your last novel, was Love is the Drug, which I've read and is fantastic. It got you a Nebula. And then you moved to Mexico and you've been down there 6 years and you've now released another novel 6 years later. Mm-hmm. Like I said, sort of just off air, there must be a relation there somehow, somewhere. Talk about, you know, sort of how connected that move is to, you know, to your writing, how it's changed your writing, if it has at all, and how significant is it now that you do have a new book out 6 years later?
It was a big shift in my life. And it definitely it shook things up a lot, you know, in terms of my writing. I would say that the changes are not as obvious on the surface, but kind of like underneath, it's been a really major seismic shift. For me, for one thing, I learned Spanish. I speak any Spanish really before I moved here. I spoke very little. And you know, and I was only planning on staying for 9 months. I just wanted a break. I just couldn't stand being in New York at that point. I needed kind of fresh air, you know, and it just hooked me. I just felt like in Mexico, I'd found a place that I could be myself. I could be who I wanted to be in a way that I couldn't really articulate, but it was very clear to me. And I just said, well, you know, I do happen to have a job where I'm not really tied to one place. And I don't have to live in the most expensive city in the U.S. Right, right. So maybe I could just try something else. And so then that just opened up all of these different possibilities because I made all these incredible new friends. I went to school. I got my master's degree at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. I just all of these different things just kind of exploded for me and my partner. Like, so all of these things were kind of part of that. And of course it influenced my writing, but I think part of it was also just, I needed space. You know, I'd written Love is a Drug. I love that novel. It was very close to my heart. It was very much like a DC novel. It's kind of going back to my roots. But I feel like after writing it, I needed some kind of break. I had this feeling that I had to immediately strike while the iron was hot. It'd gotten some attention, like I'd won the Nebula, like I need to come out with a new novel right now. And so I was just kind of writing, like I had this idea, but it was extremely half-baked, it turned out. But and I normally wouldn't have gotten started on it, but it was this feeling of pressure. And it was when I decided to just live in Mexico and not bother with trying to go back to the States and just all of the stress that kind of constantly left me with, it was when I said, well, you know, I don't have to write that. You know, I can wait. And then that was when I started working on Trouble with the Saints, was when I gave up this YA novel that I couldn't write because it was just like, you know, I need a lot of time to sit with ideas. And I just hadn't given myself that time because of this sort of artificial pressure. Mm-hmm. And that was when I started really working on this.
So you say artificial then. So that was something you self-imposed. There wasn't like a publisher saying, okay, what's next?
I mean, to some extent, your publishers are always like, hey, got anything new? You know, but it's like,
which is their job, I guess.
I think, yeah. Exactly. But it's also my job, you know, with my agent to say, okay, yes, that's possible. Or, you know what, right now I need a break, you know? And I just couldn't say no. And so I was really pushing myself. And I just remember writing pages and pages and pages and going like, what is happening in this story? And at one point I realized I had to stop was when I paused and I was like, you know, this character's ex-girlfriend who barely shows up is the most interesting character in the entire novel. Like, why am I writing this story?
Was that, that wasn't the, was that the early seeds though of Trouble the Saints or no?
No, it was completely different. It was just basically what turned out to be. I mean, I don't know if I'll ever go back to it. I mean, it has some interesting seeds, but it wasn't, I just never let it grow fully. And so it kind of was born weird and not functional. And so Trouble the Saints was actually a novella that I had written back when I was still living in New York. The very first section of Trouble the Saints was I wrote originally as a standalone, and I couldn't quite figure out what was wrong with it. Like, there was just something that wasn't quite gelling. And it was when I moved to Mexico that I thought to myself, well, you know, this strange novella that you wrote, maybe if you just kept writing it, you know, maybe, and it was a very non-commercial idea. You know, it just seemed really strange, the kind of three-part structure and everything. And that was, it was this freedom of being able to say, well, you know, I don't have to, you know, I don't have to go straight for the thing that's going to sell or that my publisher is expecting. I can just experiment with this new thing that really speaks to me.
Right. You weren't like, what this novella needs is 200 pages of epilogue.
Right. Exactly. You know, it just seems like a really wild idea to just go in with the story. But I really was obsessed with that. It just would not leave me alone.
Sure.
And so I said, okay, you know what? Let me try this.
I can, I will say then it was a worthwhile endeavor because I'm obsessed with this book. I absolutely adore it. And
thank you.
We'll talk about why for sure. A couple of things though, that sort of, as you were talking there, you know, learning, I don't know, have you must have heard of linguistic relativity, that, you know, the idea that when you learn a new language, it actually changes the way your brain works. You learned Spanish, and is that a theory you ascribe to now after learning a second language, or did you already know a second language before?
I mean, I'd learned some other languages, but in a more kind of scholastic setting. I'd majored actually in East Asian languages and cultures with a focus on Japan in college.
Okay.
So I now remember very, very little Japanese, but I studied abroad in Japan for a few months. By the end of my study abroad period, I was finally speaking Japanese fluently enough to just go around and talk to people.
Wow, nice.
And hang out. You know, like, it was not, let's say I spoke Japanese after 4 years as well as I spoke Spanish after 6 months. So it wasn't really the same, but I was getting to that experience, to that place where you start to really think about language differently.
Sure.
But I left and that kind of ended it. And so, you know, I'd say Spanish is the first language where I've had the sustained experience of suddenly looking at myself through the mirror of a language that I was not born, you know, speaking.
I assume you wouldn't consider that time in Japan wasted, though.
No, of course not. I mean, like, learning things and meeting new people, and it's always worth it.
Absolutely. And the other thing there, you were pretty prolific there for a bit. I mean, it was like three novels in 3 years at one point. Was how you ended your run there in the U.S. And now, do you think you'll ever go back to that? Or looking back now, are you like, geez, that was kind of a lot?
I mean, I think I feel like a lot of writers have pointed this out. I mean, I'm sure this hasn't happened to every writer, but to me, certainly writing novels has gotten some ways much more rewarding, but also much harder.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you know, you would hope that, like, well, now I got this under my belt, and now I'm just, but it isn't like that. I feel I am never satisfied unless I'm stretching myself, and because I'm stretching myself, it's always another challenge, and it's just hard. And it takes longer, and I realized at a certain point that I had to give up on this old notion that I could write a book in a year, because I just don't. I'm not doing it in a year. I have to just sort of allow myself to write them at the pace sure. I'm writing them.
Right.
It's certainly, I don't think I'm going to have another 6 year gap. I mean, who knows? Life changes. But I feel like that was a very specific circumstance of me needing to kind of balance myself. Again, I did write a master's thesis in the middle of that.
Sure.
So it was like I wrote a novel, but only and people read it.
Right. You weren't sitting around eating chips and watching Netflix or something.
Yeah, I mean, like, I was creating, but I definitely needed some space. You know, I feel like maybe now that I've had it, you know, I'm feeling much more creative. I have all these ideas. I'm working all the time. So they're definitely going to see more from me more regularly. Mm. But I don't think that I feel the pressure to produce in the same way that I did before, which, you know, thank goodness. And I don't think that it's as, you know, satisfying for me creatively. I know what I'm capable of and I want to get there, you know?
Mm-hmm. I realize it's a ridiculous question even before I ask it, but I can't help but wonder if you've given any thought to where you think you would have been if you had stayed in New York.
Wow. I sometimes
personally, career-wise,
yeah. You know, it's changed my life so much that I kind of sit. Sometimes I wake up and I say, "Thank God! Oh, thank God!" before I left. So it's a little bit of this, like, "Oh, what if you just stayed in the morass?" You know, but not that New York was exactly a morass, but it was definitely a place that, while I loved it, it wasn't a kind place to be living at that point for me.
Sure.
It was way too expensive and way too stressful. And I guess I would have, you know, found some kind of day job, not like that's some kind of horror, but it would have drastically changed my ability to work, and work on the kinds of things I'm writing, because, you know, for better or for worse, my kind of like mental health constellation is such that I have a hard time focusing on too many things at once.
Mm.
So when I had a day job, my writing definitely, you know, I was still writing books, but it was harder to do, and I couldn't quite kind of hit that this kind of state of creativity that I can when I have more time to dedicate myself to it. You know, so I feel like it would have slowed things down. It might have made things more interesting in a different way. You know, I couldn't know.
I mean, those are the sort of rigors, you know, the rigors of life that can stifle creativity in a lot of ways, right? I mean,
yeah.
anxiety, you know, having to pay bills, simple, like, right? Simple, innocuous right. things, but highly stressful, healthcare, like,
yeah.
incredibly stressed. These are stressful things. And it can absolutely, you know, it depresses, you know, most people. From just keeps them from even just going to the park, let alone writing a novel. So, you know, just to put a bow on this part of the conversation, I assume you're pretty happy, pretty stoked with the move and where you're at creatively in your life right now.
Yeah.
I
mean, it's been amazing.
Speaking of back home, things are not great right now. Yeah. All over the world for sure, but you know, right now in the US, it's certainly relevant. Trouble of the Saints, you know, race right. is a big part of it, big part of that story. I was talking to Kaylin Baron a couple of weeks ago, who has a really awesome book out right now, Cinderella's Dead. I don't know if you've read that or not. It's amazing.
No, I've heard of it. It looks amazing.
It is really great. I'm really digging this sort of like revisionist history stuff that's happening right now with a lot of authors, because I think a lot of history needs to be revised.
Yeah.
So one of the things going on in the States right now, and she had an interesting thing, you know, we were talking about, I think I put it very poorly, but sort of like the Black Lives Matter bump right now, a lot of black authors are getting, or did get. She was sort of, you know, lamented to me that it lasted a couple of weeks and then she's noticed it started to die off already. I'm wondering if you have any opinion on that at all. If you felt this, if you feel the same way, and because I've noticed it too. I'm a white dude, and I've just noticed just on my timeline, it's died off on the people I follow who I see. Hey, what's going on here? I've even noticed it starts slowing down a bit.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on any of that right now?
I mean, in terms of the bump, you know, it was brief. I'm not surprised by that in any way. I mean, mm-hmm. to the extent to
neither which am I. I'm not surprised either. Yeah, but it's just like, I think I just fool myself each time, right, into thinking, oh, this will be the time. This is the one that'll change it for the good. But maybe I don't.
Yeah. I've been in publishing for more than a decade, and so I have definitely seen a lot of cycles of, oh, now we have to pay attention, you know, and they, I'm not saying they do nothing, because they do. They, every one of them has a small but important effect in moving that needle. I'm sure that some people who work in publishing can almost certainly trace like some of their ability to finally break into one of those cycles of people demanding some kind of structural institutional change. Because, you know, but it's really hard. It's hard to break in. It's hard once you've broken in to kind of gain support. I feel really lucky in my publisher and in my editor, which is Tor and Miriam Weinberg, because I feel that they've really decided to focus on me as a writer. And my career. And so like, that's another reason why there's like, I don't have this kind of pressure that I did before where it was like, well, you got something, now you got to give me something else because this is the only way we're going to publish you ever, you know, like your career is over if you don't sell this book. I mean, you see something similar in Hollywood, and I feel like it's kind of starker there. So it's maybe a little easier to talk about where, you know, white actors or white film showrunners or screenwriters can have like bomb after bomb, and it's just like, well, the market wasn't right, or well, you know, we just need to like wait for like the audience to be there for them, and they're going to be the next star. You know, a lot of people who are common names had like a number of bombs before we got to know who they were. You know, but if the second that a black showrunner or a person of color or like any kind of movie that has, you know, not that kind of standard Hollywood story gets any kind of money behind it, if it doesn't do extraordinarily well, it's all just, well, people don't want to watch these kinds of stories and we just can't bet on you anymore, you know? And it's horrible because it's this feeling that you have to not just be good, but be brilliant. And the pressure to be brilliant makes it almost impossible to be good in a lot of ways. It's because you don't have any time. You don't have the same kind of leisure to do weird experiments like I did in Trouble with the Saints in a lot of cases, you know?
It's interesting. I remember a few years ago, I read this great article, and the name escapes me who wrote it, but it was really great. It was sort of that year when like Captain Marvel, you know, these movies and Wonder Woman and all that was coming out. Mm-hmm. And the article was about, you know, we need to get it to a point where it becomes so normal that, you know, there are women leading films, both in front and behind the camera, that they're allowed to put out crap. Right?
Yes.
It's not every single female-led superhero movie needs to be the greatest thing anyone's ever seen. And that was sort of the talk of the time, right? Because there was, you know, even the negativity of surrounding it or whatever it was at the time. And, mm-hmm. and that was the talk. And it's just to your point, that's where we need to get to, right? Where, like you said, it's okay, you know, if let's say Ava DuVernay's next movie bombs, that's okay, because she's proven she's incredible, and there's no reason anyone should not continue to invest in her work.
Exactly, and not use it as even worse, not just to paint, say that, yeah, Ava DuVernay, she's over, we can't support her, but then say now we can't support any other black women directors, you know, because that's what they do now. It's like this astonishing ability to just say, okay, we'll give you one chance, and they put all of this weight on their shoulders. It's impossible to live up to that. It's just this, we're humans, not superhumans, you know? It just makes me so angry because it stifles so much creativity.
It's not only stifling, but like you said, it also, because they use a paintbrush, right? Mm-hmm. What really upsets me is how many folks will never even get the chance. And there's genius out there, right? Yeah. that will never get to know because of it. And that's the stuff that like makes me cry. What one quick thing too, then, before we really talk about Trouble the Saints, was I was watching you on Instagram on a live chat, and you mentioned that your parents were, I don't think you called them protesters. Did you call them protesters or just active? I think maybe.
Yeah. I mean,
that's how you put it.
So my dad was, and my aunt and, my mom, not so much. She's a little young, but my dad was very, very active.
Okay.
And on the front lines of the civil rights movement in the 60s.
Is he still alive?
Yeah.
He is. And I'm wondering if you've inherited any of that, and just sort of, because sort of you're on the outside looking in right now at the U.S., do you feel any urge to buy a plane ticket and join a march, or you?
I mean, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's very hard. I feel like, you know, right now I have my life here. It's extremely hard to go back to the States. I mean, if nothing else, again, you know, I just don't have the money to really be traveling back.
Well, and not to cast judgment saying you're a terrible black person because you're not flying back to the US and protesting, just sort of just more relation because because your father was.
What I mean is I've thought about it, right? Like I've had that calculation basically where I'm like, would it be worth it? Could I go back? Like, could I say something, you know? But it seems to me that after having, you know, considered it, in a lot of ways, it's strange. It's strange. It's wonderful in a lot of ways to see this sort of intensity and power and demand for change and radical change. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people calling and about time, you know, for major serious reforms, like abolishing the police and abolishing our prison system, which as far as I'm concerned is like, you know, about time. Like we are not, a lot of the structural inequalities that people are protesting are not accidents. They're not things that are going to get changed by better training. They're straight up parts of the white patriarchal imperialist system of US governance, you know? And so I feel a lot of pride and kind of worry, you know, and also the historical continuities with my family. And but at the end of the day, what I do is I write. And so it seems to me that the best thing I can do is to keep writing stories that not maybe necessarily speaking directly to this moment, but are speaking to these same issues and these same struggles, and my ability to finally deal with that. I feel like it's kind of funny, you know, that I wrote a novel that was so very much a part of the Black experience in America when I was in Mexico, you know, when I had a little bit of that distance.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into the novel, Trouble the Saints. And because it is relevant, and that's really the kind of shitty part, right? Because we, right? It's because the novel takes place in 1942, a crazy time in America, the world, they were in the middle of a world war.
Yeah.
But America, the Black experience in America in the 40s, I'm 44 years old, I'm white, trust me, I've never experienced anything remotely close to it, right? And, if you think about it for a second and you look at the 40s, what the Black experience was like, because the wounds were still very much healing and very much alive. And, you know, there was things currently happening and it's so close to, you know, not that long ago, and everyone was still reeling from slavery. Well, there's still the prison system is slavery, but, and now all of a sudden this country that brutalized you is asking you to buck up and go fight this foreign enemy.
Yes.
And not understanding that, you know, the evil still existed at home for, I almost said so many of the Black people, but all of the Black people.
Yeah.
So setting the book in the 40s, what was sort of, where did that come from? What was the idea behind that? Was I even close to the reason why?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you talk about how kind of the legacy of slavery was just so very much, you know, alive and present in the 40s. And that's very true. It's also, you know, true now. And so I think part of what, you know, I actually think that one of the kind of most ignorant things that a lot of people and, you know, white people generally say to Black people is like, it was a long time ago, just, you know, buck up, basically just forget about it. Like, why are you going on about slavery? Like, it was so long ago, but it was not that long ago.
Okay.
It was not that long ago, guys. Like it was, you to think, especially because the legacies of slavery have never really ended. I mean, if there was some kind of actual serious sustained reconstruction, because reconstruction that period was, it had the potential to dramatically change American history, and it was squashed. And the squashing and the systems of repression developed in order to squash the promise of reconstruction are the legacies that we are still living with today. You know, mm-hmm. So as a matter of fact, it's very much, It's very much a part of our daily lives, and of course in the lives of my grandparents, which is more or less the time period that I set the novel in.
Right.
And so part of it was just the kind of interest in, you know, the inheritance of trauma. Mm-hmm. As you say, the inheritance, my grandparents' inheritance of the trauma of their grandparents who were slaves. Mm-hmm. And my inheritance of the trauma of my grandparents who kind of grew up in this intermediate time.
Right.
Where especially, I'm glad that you mentioned, you know, the impact of the world wars, because in both cases, you know, during World War I and during World War II, the experiences of Black soldiers had a huge impact on our extreme dissatisfaction with what was happening at home.
Right.
Because they would, in a lot of cases, the Black soldiers would come back from the wars having experienced this sort of parallel U.S. with much more integration. They were often in segregated units, but even so, eventually the units would get integrated. And, like, you know, there's just a lot more mixing, a lot more respect, autonomy. They were soldiers at the end of the day when right. they were at war. And when they came back, they were targeted for wearing their uniforms, for being veterans, a lot of race riots, you know, so-called race riots, i.e., white yep. massacres of Black people, were started or sparked because of white fury at Black veterans wearing their uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened at the end of World War I, and it's something that also kind of had like the long game of leading up to the kind of explosion of protest movements in the 60s, because a lot of people came back, a lot of Black men came back from the war and were like, you know, what is this? You know, why, how can I go and fight for my country? And they come back and they treat me worse than dirt, you know? And there's
the man whose life I just saved is getting a parade, and
right.
I'm still living on Skid Row, and dare I wear my uniform, I'm getting, you know, abused.
Right? Exactly. Or lynched, you know?
Yes. And that, yeah.
And that was just reality. But I think that experience, and that's kind of speaks to some of the themes of the novel, you know, where that experience of being outside of that power system for a bit made it impossible for them to go back into it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things about this book, I mean, it covers so many different things. We just talked about racism, grief, trauma, fear, desire. There's a ton of love. There's a huge love aspect to this book, which I am a sucker for every single time. I'm a bit of a sap that way. One of the things...
Saps unite. I totally am. Too.
Okay, perfect. One thing, though, I get a little squeamish with physical sex. That's just my problem. I'm not super comfortable with it. But I thought your depiction of it was poetic and beautiful, and it didn't make me, you know, squeamish at all. I thought it was gorgeous. This is the part of the interview where I just lick your boots for a couple of minutes. wonderful, just beautiful prose. You turn a phrase so well. One of the things that I loved about it was sort of something, I made a really bad joke earlier about, you know, it's 200 pages of epilogue, but it is this, the book is like that. You know, the scene that should have, would end most films is in the first third of the book. And then you spend the rest of the book dealing, which is fantastic, because we never get that, right? We don't mm-hmm. get that. We get the big, big battle at the end, and then we don't see we don't get the PTSD, right?
Right.
So, I hope out there, if people have read the book, you know what we're even talking about. We're having like a detailed discussion about a book we haven't even really described yet. But I'm going to describe it in the intro. I'm not going to do it now. I don't want to waste any time. But people, just look it up. It's on. You can Wikipedia it or whatever and find out what, you know, the summary of the book. But basically, we've got these group of people living in the 40s in, you know, Harlem and Manhattan, and it all centers around the Pelican. Doesn't center around the Pelican Club, but definitely a lot happens at the Pelican Club, which is ran by this mob boss named Victor, who I loved Victor, by the way. Not love Victor, just like as a character. So fascinating to me. And one of the things you mentioned in that Instagram talk I didn't read it this way. You mentioned, you know, he wanted one of the things in this book is they're called the hands, and basically the hands are, refer to them as a magical power or just an inherent gift? I'm not sure how you describe it.
I mean, because I am writing fantasy, people tend to just call it magic, and that's fine, because it is. I felt like I always was like a little leery of describing it that way, because I wanted it to be at the very least a little more... I always think of magic and fantasy novels as being kind of big and splashy, and I didn't want it to be like that. And so I tried kind of pulling it back to being like quieter, more, I don't know, well, homegrown, you know? And so I tend to describe it as a power or a gift, but
And plus we have such a weird way of, you know, North Americanizing things, like even the word magic, we just automatically jump to rabbit out of a hat, right?
Right, exactly.
In your story, non-white folks, are you saying that definitively, that not whites do not have the hands?
They do not have the hands.
Okay, that's the way I read it. I mean, I don't remember. You kind of say that, but you don't make it necessarily definitive. So non-white folks are born with what's called the hands. Each of them has a different gift where their hands allow them all sorts of sort of wonderful abilities. In the lead character's case, Phyllis Green, P, who was born with just the ability to just deadly accuracy, I guess. Is that the way to describe it?
Yeah, she's just extraordinarily good aim.
If it was allowed at the time, I guess they probably would have just made her a baseball pitcher or something, that's not the way things worked back then. So, and not for a very long time, not ever really for women, still no professional baseball for women. So instead she becomes an assassin for hire, essentially, for this mob boss named Victor. One of the things I was getting at there was I read Victor as being almost ambiguous on the hands, not necessarily a believer, but he's just pragmatic about it. But because he's a mob boss, he needs to hedge his bets, right? He has to cover all of his bases. Mm-hmm. I think you were saying in the interview I watched the other day was that, no, he believes in the hands, and he's just so insanely jealous that he doesn't have them. I found him more pragmatic about the hands, though. Like, you know, if I can't have them, nobody can, which then takes them on this journey of him having them all removed from the earth, essentially.
You know, I think that he's certainly pragmatic about it. In this sense of, it's interesting to describe it as jealousy, because I guess in a way it is jealousy, but it's a certain sort of normalized jealousy. What I mean to say is that the way he thinks about things is, you know, I can have some things, other people can have some things, but I cannot have, those other people cannot be black and brown people. Like, black and brown people cannot have things that I don't have.
Right.
And so however he got a whiff of this power that some people of color have, because it's in this story too, you know, it's pretty well known in those communities, but white people don't, I mean, if they heard about it, they don't believe in it. Mm-hmm. And most of them haven't even heard of it.
Sure.
So Victor is unusual in the sense that he spends enough time and listens to enough black and brown people that he has heard of it. And it did occur to him, you know, what if this is true? And in the sense of, does it work very well? I think Walter makes it pretty clear, like, it doesn't work that well, you know, and to the extent that it might not even be really real, but that's where the pragmatism comes in.
Right.
He's going to use it however he uses it. So at least by putting it out there that he has this ability, he keeps people in line. And he gets to steal this power that isn't meant for him, which is important because he's someone who's always grown up believing that he should and by right has the right to all of these things, even if they weren't at all meant for him. You know, and that to me is more, well, I mean, it's like, it's a metaphor. It's also just the way things work. You know, a lot of modern post-imperialist history is just a lot of white people stealing a lot of culture and power from you know, non-white people.
You're being kind. All of it. We stole all of it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, certainly yeah. tried to, you know, there's yeah. a lot of resistance in big and small ways. This is a history of colonized peoples, you know, sure. and a lot of that resistance is hiding our power and our art and our culture from the white gaze. And like, that's part of what's going on there. So I feel like Victor's role was very much that of being, you know, as Tamara says, like the whitest white man she could find.
Right. Oh, Tamara, love her. What a great character. Victor, he's a racist for sure. He's also a sociopath. That's a blurred line back then, right? I mean, because when it's like, when everything is one thing, none of it is. You see what I'm saying? So like, because all of society was racist, it's like, you know, he is, there's no doubt about it. And he goes on that, says those terrible things at the end, near the end.
You know, and in a weird way, like he's probably kind of, I mean, if we're going to put like racism on a scale, he's probably less racist than like most right. people around him.
That's kind of what I meant.
He's the one who runs the integrated club. Like he's the one who actually pays some attention. And that's kind of what I mean, that racism is a system. And the reason why white people don't have the hands is because they have the power. Like the hands are there to counterbalance that power. And so I wasn't going to give white patriarchy like extra magic. You know, it has it.
They have just by being born, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Right. And then, you know, one of the quotes, you know, they give a little, but they, you know, they, you don't say pound of flesh, but we have to give up. Sure, we have the hands, but we have to give up a pound of flesh for it. I think you call it a soul instead. Mm-hmm. One of the things I loved about Victor's character and his relationship with them is, I mean, he's a big city slave owner, right? Essentially, because they're all for hire. And talk about Tamara, which is why she's such a great character. And so the book is, you know, from three points of view, essentially, not all first person, which I loved, by the way. Phyllis Green, who we already talked about, her best friend, Tamara, who's a dancer at the Pelican. And Dev, who's half Indian. I don't want to get too spoilery with the book, but he's
This is the hard part with talking about Dev. I'm like, oh.
he's a bartender at the Pelican. Let's go. Okay. We'll leave it at that. And he was in a relationship with Tamara for a bit, but the true love is Phyllis, and vice versa, I would say.
Yeah.
And that's the crux of the love story for this book. And it's all through the book, and there's a lot of sort of like time jumping and stuff. You know, you go back and retell certain things from different points of view
right.
later on in the book, which make the picture that much more clear. What was the idea behind sort of that when you, like you said, so now we, you know, I didn't know that it was a novella that you expanded upon. Was that the sort of the light bulb moment for you when you thought about how am I going to expand this? It was like, oh, I know what I can do. I can sort of tell it in from three points of view.
It was definitely when I just kept thinking, right? Like, well, what happens? You know, because as you say, the point where that story ought to end, where we expect a noir story to end, is very clear. And it's the end of the first section, right? And so when I couldn't stop thinking about, you know, the epilogue, you know, like what is the PTSD from this? How on earth do they survive this? I thought to myself, you know, what would be amazing would be to keep telling it, but tell it from Dev's point of view.
Right.
Because part of that is one of my favorite series of novels is The Lymed Chronicles by Dorothy Dunnett. Mm-hmm. It's just like this classic of historical fiction. It's just brilliant. I don't know what to tell you. I love this series. I mean, it's so dense. And one of the best things, the kind of this effect that Dorothy Dunnett manages over the course of the series is that she has this incredibly fiercely charismatic central character who very rarely has the point of view in over the course of thousands of pages. It's seven dense novels. And so what you see is him through the perspective of everyone who loves and hates him. Mm-hmm. And so this kaleidoscopic view of him it has this really interesting effect because it puts these panes of glass between the reader and the character, and it makes it plays games with them, and so you're always you have this awareness of things you know about the character that this particular viewpoint character doesn't know, but mm-hmm. you also are seeing the things this character is doing through this viewpoint character, and sometimes you're kind of swayed by the viewpoint character's kind of take on it, and mm-hmm. sometimes that's more or less accurate, and sometimes you know she switches and you suddenly realize all of these other things that viewpoint character hadn't noticed. Mm-hmm. And so it changes your understanding of the main character in a way that you just couldn't, it would be very hard to achieve if you were just straight telling the story from his perspective. And so part of what I loved was this opportunity to take a Black woman and treat her like that, to show her in all of her complexity, not just from her own point of view, but from the point of view of people who love her. But they don't always understand her in the same way that she doesn't always understand them. And that was where I was so excited to be able to show all of the stuff that she didn't understand about Dev and that Dev did in some ways understand about her.
Right. One of the interesting things that I like you did with Phyllis was she's never violent in the book. It's always inferred, right?
Right.
And like you retell a couple of, one key incident for sure is sort of told from different perspectives, but mm-hmm. you know, there's no violence from her. She pulls her knife out a couple times and stuff like that, but doesn't.
Yeah, but she doesn't.
Right.
She doesn't throw.
Because that's not the focus of the story. This is post Victor's Angel is what they sort of, the euphemism for her. So I thought that was a really, really interesting way to write Phyllis because it makes her really easy to like, unlike Tamara, who isn't easy to like, and you write her stuff sort of not in first person, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times when you write third person, that sort of like has a way of tempering like a reader's expectations of a character. Mm-hmm. Was that intentional then? Because she's the hardest one to sort of wrap your head around. Victor's Victor. There's right. no, you know, Walter is Walter, you know, Phyllis is infinitely complicated and I would love to just learn more about Phyllis for sure. But, and even Dev is just so moralistically to me simple. You know, I can understand Dev. Tamara's hard to get your head around a lot of the times. Uh-huh. Is that sort of why you went third person with her or?
It wasn't so much because of her as a character. I mean, I love Tamara. Like, I think she's,
so do I. No, I do too. Fantastic.
I love her because she's making hard choices in a hard world. In a lot of ways, absolutely. You know, she's making very similar choices to the ones that Phyllis made, but she's making them more passively. Mm-hmm. And so she doesn't want to admit that that's still a choice, right? And that's kind of her struggle. And I love that. There's something about writing her where I tried writing her in first person. It didn't quite work. Right. And I felt that it didn't quite work because I think maybe as a writer or just it was that effect maybe of when you write someone in first person, you get all of their self-justifications and you just sort of like believe them more. And I did need there to be a kind of and partly because she's the oracle, she's the person who's watching the story. And mm-hmm. so I needed her to have a certain kind of distance from the story because she's the one mediating between these kind of forces that animate the hands and her cards and the reader. And so that's like, that's kind of where she is in the story. And so as like the kind of gaze of the novel starts to pull back towards in the last few pages of the novel, it's like the story passes from the hands of the people who have been telling it up until now, you know, until it kind of goes out and it ends in a certain way. And then it kind of opens itself up for, you know, the next generation.
Right. And it's, you know, occurred to me reading it too, is that we were easy to give Phyllis a pass, but Tamara didn't have, there's the two things Phyllis has that Tamara doesn't, which, mm-hmm. You know, gave Phyllis an advantage, a huge advantage, certainly within the world, the small little bubble in which they exist, the color of her skin, the shade of her skin, sorry. And of course the hands, Tamara doesn't have the hands. So that was one of the great things I loved about this book. And that's one of the things that's been coming up a lot, in novels that I've, you know, been looking at and focused on a little bit, especially with like, you know, I don't know if you've read any Dread Nation books, Justine Ireland's books and stuff, deals a lot with colorism. And so Tamara, you know, it's assimilation versus passing, right? So Phyllis,
right.
Phyllis passes. Phyllis is the passer. Tamara is the assimilator. So Phyllis is a light shade of brown, very light shade, can pass as white, which helps her infinitely in this world. Tamara is dark skinned, so she has to assimilate. She has no choice but to assimilate.
Exactly.
So she's doing what she has to do. And I like, you know, the idea that she just goes full out, becomes exotic in a way, right? Because she's going to take full advantage of her dark skin, and she makes this exotic character, a dancer in this instance.
You know, she allows it, like a lot of all the characters, really. I mean, she says, fine, you know, I'll give Victor this, and so he'll give me this in exchange. And what he gives her in exchange is the power to kind of become this curator, ruler of this kind of avant-garde art space that the Pelican becomes when they're not trying to make money.
Well, and she, and also you can't fault her for wanting nice things, because she comes from the South. And her experience growing up black is much different.
Yeah.
And when you finally get a taste of, I you know, she talks about, you know, I don't remember if she says bourbon, but nice liquor and fur coats and being treated yeah. differently, right? Treated different with a little bit of reverence for the first time in her life. You can't, how could you fault somebody for wanting a little bit?
Exactly. And I don't, and I think, you know, it's interesting that, you know, as a reader, you can judge Tamara, but Phyllis certainly never judges her for it.
No, never once. No.
Yeah. And neither does exactly what Tamara is doing. And she totally understands it. And she is not making any kind of moral claim on Tamara's choices.
No character judges Tamara. She judges herself.
Yeah.
And it's whether it's guilt or, you know, the past, I can't remember, her childhood friend that she saw who was hung at Pete.
Yeah. No.
Yes.
His name was Pete.
Right. Haunts her, you know, up until the end. And, you know, so she's an incredible character. And I think she's sort of probably more in line with the times than any other character, probably who puts herself in that position, living in that world. I think she to me seemed like the most realistic character. Because
certainly very much of her time.
Right. That's what I mean. Yeah. That's, you know, she seems like somebody who would fully exist in that time, knowing where she's from and what was just, you know, happening not that long ago.
Right.
I think the time here, I guess we should probably have kept you long enough, I think, but you could see, I could talk about this for a long time. let's wrap it up, because I've kept you long enough and you've got lots of things to do, I'm sure. One of the great things I love about this book is, you know, there's this illusion of choice that, you know, they think they all have, and, you know, a lot of it, they manifest themselves in the end. And I think that's why this book is very bleak. But there is, if you look for it, a little bit of hope, certainly, I think, spread throughout.
I think there is.
Yeah, I think there is too. It's there for sure. I mean, I won't lie, you definitely broke my heart with one decision you made in the book, but I won't, that's spoilery, so we won't talk about it, but that's okay. I think if you had have gone sort of the other direction, I don't necessarily think it would have made sense from a narrative standpoint. So I think you made the right decision for sure. But you know, you know, when you read a story and you fall in love with people and you want only the best for them, and when things maybe don't work out necessarily, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah. But this book is about so many things, and I think it's so relevant to today, and it's sad that it's still relevant, but it is. And I can't thank you enough for writing it. I'm absolutely in love with it. And trying to get other people on board with reading it, I'm doing my best. So I think I have to believe you've gotten nothing but positive feedback from it so far. I mean, aside from just maybe the odd asshole out there.
I mean, I've been really just so happy with my release week. You know, I've kind of been off the grid for so long, and so seeing people excited to read it and having read it parts or all of it and telling me, like, why did you do that at the end? You know, I mean, it just warms my heart. So
during a pandemic too, I mean, because normally you'd be probably,
yes,
you'd be on a book tour or, you know, doing something anyways. So it's kind of a weird time for authors. I talked to a lot of them and it's a weird time because normally they'd be out there and, but it's a great thing. I think this technology has really made it so much. I mean, this couldn't, I mean, imagine 30 years ago.
Oh yeah. I mean, like at least this pandemic didn't happen in 95. That's all.
Right. Imagine pre-Windows. Yeah. Like you couldn't just, you know, there'd be no, would they even release books in a pandemic? Right. Would they couldn't, how could they,
I guess eBooks were possible in 95, but no one had them.
But imagine, right, pressing, like you wouldn't, they just wouldn't.
Yeah.
How could you? It's amazing. So, you know, if there's a silver lining, it's we get the thanks to the magic of the internet, which isn't totally reliable for you down there, but no. not all the time. But thanks to it, I mean, I get to watch you on Instagram and, you know, get to talk, and it's an amazing thing. So I think if there's a silver lining during this pandemic, which there aren't too many, but if there is one, it's, you know, you're able to still get the word out and still get this out into the world, but feel the love come back, I think, in a way, right?
Yeah, I mean, being able to engage with people is what it's about, you know? So even if it's not what I was expecting, as in person, it's still amazing.
Sure. Trouble the Saints is out now, so please, everybody, wherever you... Do you have a preferred method for people to buy them? You don't want the crazy bald white guy to get any more money, right?
I mean, so, I definitely do not. there's definitely... There's always bookshop.org, which is great because you can connect with your local bookseller
and order them. That is a great resource for sure. So we don't want any more money to go to Victor, that crazy Victor. We're going to call him.
Exactly. Don't give your money to Victor, please.
He's got. Anyways, I can't thank you enough. Have a great weekend, and I can't wait to see what's next. So enjoy the rest of your day.
There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. A huge thanks to Elijah for taking the time to speak with me, both on and off air. If you get a chance, I highly encourage you to take the opportunity. She's thoughtful, intelligent, and one of the more gracious people I've met recently. Trouble the Saints is available now, and we support local businesses around here where possible, so please go to bookshop.org to find the nearest indie bookstore near you. Please buy this book. You won't regret it. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Bye for now.